This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM in good old McLean County, 92.5 FM in Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, and 97.1 in Lincoln, covering most of central Illinois. We're going to have a great show for you today. Our topic is going to be liberal suicide, and we'll explain that more as we go along. I'm here with my wife, Lynn. I hope everybody had a happy Labor Day weekend. We were gone for that weekend, and I hope that everybody else was enjoying themselves. I think the weather mostly was pretty nice. I think Saturday was nice, and maybe we had a little bit of a cloudy and some dampness on Sunday, but I think Monday wasn't bad. So it was a pretty good weekend for everybody, I think. Remember, this program is brought to you by you. So if you would like to make a donation, go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com, because we are brought to you by you, and any help you can give us, we would appreciate. You'll find out a lot of information also at our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. You can call us at 807-2427, and that's area code 309. And again, as I said, I'm here with my wife, Lynn, and I'll turn the program over to her and let her make the introduction, and then we'll talk a little bit about that topic, liberal suicide. So,
yes, okay. Have you been listening to the news, especially Catholic news, lately? It's something to think about, keep up with the National Catholic News and the news on EWTN, where you get news that's fair and unbiased, more or less. But have you heard that in the last 10 days, in Ontario, Canada, someone stole the tabernacle with the consecrated hosts in it? You know, you just don't walk into a church and take the tabernacle and the hosts with the hosts in it. Those tabernacles are not real gold. They're gold finish and probably steel in the back. And it's a good thing they aren't worth a lot of money, because they find them. For instance, this tabernacle, they found it had been thrown in a river, apparently, or in some water. Well, in that case, the host would have dissolved and the presence of Christ would be gone. But they don't know for sure, because in some of these instances, the hosts are taken. They don't want the tabernacle. They want the hosts for witchcraft and so forth. The desecration and the decapitation of the statues of Mary and the saints that are out and about, churches being defaced, and the lector punched in the face when leaving the sanctuary. That happened in Philadelphia on August 23rd. It's not very long ago, 23rd of August. All these things are going on, and yet, what do you hear about them? What does the church have to say about them? There's a Father James Altman. Have you heard of him, of this man in La Crosse, Wisconsin? He's been censored by his bishop, Bishop Callahan, for his streaming his videos and in his talks. And the reason why he was censored is because he says you cannot be Catholic and be a Democrat, period. And he goes on to explain there is nothing in the Democratic Party platform that a Catholic could stand behind, nothing. It's all anti-Catholic. So you can't call yourself a Catholic and vote for them. This is what Father Altman says. I've watched the video. It's wonderful. You can get it on YouTube. You can get that. You could try Facebook. I'm not sure about that. But you go to on YouTube and put in his name, Father James Altman, or Complicit Clergy. He talks like the priests used to talk to us and warn us about what you do, you have to answer for. And he pulls no punches. I was refreshed when I listened to it. It was good to hear the truth for once. But his bishops because Father James Martin, he was one of the targets, because I don't know if he introduced the prayer or what at the Democratic convention, but Father Martin, James Martin, is really into the alphabet groups. And Father Altman pointed that out. How come he gets up and speaks, yet any of the rest of the priests say anything, get in trouble? He asked that question, too. But do listen to him if you can pull him up before they take him off. He's been censored, and he may have canonical measures taken against him for telling the truth. And it's really, really sad, I think. He said, everything the church teaches, the Democratic platform is against. So how can you stand there and say you're a Catholic? You know, we got Pelosi and Biden. Well, James Martin and all his friends, he got together, and they have just overwhelmed the Diocese of La Crosse with information, with complaints about Father James Altman. But he does have a supporter, Bishop Strickland of Texas. He supports him 100%. Bishop Strickland says, thank you. You showed the bishops, you showed us shepherds what we should be doing. Now we wonder why all this stuff has happened. How can, you know, somebody be punched in the face and everything stolen, the church is defaced and so forth? Are these the signs of the time? Is this what Mary was talking about, Fatima, and that Russia would spread her errors? Because we're talking about Marxism and socialist Marxism here. That's what it's all around in the Black Lives Matter organization. And Father's against this. Some of his other topics that he talked about, that I watched some of them, make sure your lamps are full of oil, Catholic privilege, woe to the shepherds, and the one I liked best was, what are you going to do when, silence is complicity, and he asks, are you going to play dumb in front of Jesus after you die when you stand up and are judged? Well, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't realize it. That's a sin of omission. And he said, you can't do that. You have to keep yourself involved and speak out when it needs to be done. So I think Bob's got a good program lined up here, and he's going to tell you, or not tell you, share with you some things that he has found out in his research and so forth, what's behind it all, how this, how these movements begin, and for us to take note.
Well, I'm going to be probably asking some of the same questions that you were sort of hinting at and asking in your introduction here, and that people are asking themselves, we're seeing on television and hearing on the radio and just in the news, and people are wondering what's going on in our country. And hopefully we have an article here that will bear some light on this and maybe bring people to a better understanding of what is happening and what is going on. But there's an old saying that evil prevails because good men do nothing. But the question is, why is this so? Have you ever wondered why so many people stand by while they're seeing things going on? Why is it that so many of our authorities in various cities around the country are standing by while supposedly peaceful protesters are actually out rioting, destroying property, burning down buildings, in some instances injuring the police and injuring other people? And there's been even some deaths and some attempted deaths. There have been people who their buildings were set on fire and there was an attempt to keep them in there while the buildings were burning. These things are going on, and yet there seems to be little resistance. And so a lot of people are asking, why is this so? Why do authorities allow violence to prevail? Why do people deny that evil is taking place in the first place, or that violence is taking place? Why are they unwilling to act? And why so much aversion or denial of the factual truth? I mean, what is going on? Is it just because this is an election year and this is solely political? Is it because certain politicians are wanting to get the votes of people that may be carrying on along these lines, and hopefully they will change after the election, not wanting to cause people that are doing some of these things to, you know, vote against them or not vote? So is it just politics? Is it a product of our democracy itself? You know, the desire for votes or the desire to appease the crowd. But why the unopposed violence? And the fact is that it actually goes deeper than most people think. And so I'm going to read an article here called Suicide of the Liberals, and it's written by Gary Saul Morrison, and he is Lawrence B. Dumas Professor of the Arts and Humanities at Northwestern University, just right up the road from us. In Evanston, near, you know, Chicago, in the Chicago area. And he writes here, between 1900 and 1917, waves of unprecedented terror struck Russia. Several parties professing incompatible ideologies competed and cooperated in causing havoc. Between 1905 and 1907, nearly 4,500 government officials and about as many private individuals were killed or injured. Between 1908 and 1910, authorities recorded 19,957 terrorist acts and revolutionary robberies, doubtless omitting many from remote areas. As the foremost historian of Russian terrorism, Anna Geifen, observes, robbery, extortion, and murder became more common than traffic accidents. So what was going on here, and what is going on in our country?
It's happening here. Just look around.
It says anyone wearing a uniform was a candidate for a bullet to the head or sulfuric acid to the face. And, of course, our police wearing uniforms are targets going on in our country now. Country estates were burnt down. They were called rural illuminations. And businesses were extorted or blown up. Bombs were tossed at random into railroad carriages, restaurants, and theaters. And we're having a lot of this theaters, restaurants, and so forth being targeted. Not this violently yet, but if it keeps on going, it may get to that point.
Well, it's being done over in Europe and the Middle East.
And far from regretting the death and maiming of innocent bystanders, terrorists boasted of killing as many as possible, either because the victims were likely bourgeois or because any murder helped bring down the old order. A group of anarcho-communists threw bombs laced with nails into cafes bustling with 200 customers in order to see how the foul bourgeois will squirm in death agony. Instead of the pendulum swinging back, a metaphor of inevitability that excuses people from taking a stand. You know, Lynn, how that is. People say, oh, well, it's going to an extreme, but the pendulum will swing back the other way.
Yeah, we keep waiting for that.
Well, it took 70 years in Russia for it to swing, or, you know, the Soviet Union for it to swing back the other way. At any point, the killing grew and grew, both in numbers and in cruelty. Sadism replaced simple killing, and it seems as if the violence is getting more sadistic in our own country as things go along. It says here, as Geifman explains, the need to inflict pain was transformed from an abnormal, irrational compulsion experienced only by unbalanced personalities into a formally verbalized obligation for all committed revolutionaries. One group threw traitors into vats of boiling water. Others were still more inventive. Women torturers were especially admired. So how did educated liberal society respond to such terrorism? you would think it would have raised up and with one voice condemned it. Did it? What was the position of the Constitutional Democratic, that is the cadet, it was called over there, party, and its deputies in the Duma, that is the parliament set up in 1905? Though cadets advocated democratic constitutional procedures and did not themselves engage in terrorism, they aided the terrorists in any way they could. Cadets collected money for terrorists, turned their homes into safe houses, and called for total amnesty for arrested terrorists who pledged to continue the mayhem. Sound familiar?
Don't put them in jail, huh?
Cadet Party Central Committee member N.N. Shepkin declared that the party did not regard terrorists as criminals at all, but as saints and martyrs. Again, don't we have a familiar ring here? The official cadet paper, Herald of the Party of People's Freedom, never published an article condemning political assassination. The party leader, Paul Milyakov, declared that all means are now legitimate and all means should be tried. And this is from liberal people who, prior to this, preached, you know, a philosophy of peace and tolerance. When asked to condemn terrorism, another liberal leader in the Duma, Ivan Petrenevich, famously replied, "Condemn terror? That would be the moral death of the party." And isn't that a lot what we have today, this huge reluctance to condemn the violence that is going on and the worry that this would somehow or another hurt the movement, hurt the supposed movement against racism and injustice? And it goes on, it says, "Not just lawyers, teachers, doctors, and engineers, but even industrialists and bank directors raised money for the terrorists." And don't we have a lot of that going on today? "Doing so signaled advanced opinion and good manners." And don't we have a lot of virtue signaling today? A quote attributed to Lenin, "When we are ready to kill the capitalists, they will sell us the rope," would have been more accurately rendered as, "They will buy us the rope and hire us to use it on them." True to their word, when the Bolsheviks gained control, their organ of terror, the Cheka, liquidated members of all opposing parties, beginning with the very cadets who supported them. Why didn't the liberals and businessmen see it coming? And this is what we're going to talk about when we come back. So we're going to take a break here. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Here's an easy way to donate to Catholic Spirit Radio. As an Amazon shopper, you can donate 0.5% of your purchase cost to Catholic Spirit Radio, also known as 2820 Communications. Before making a purchase, you will always need to log into smile.amazon.com, search and select 2820 Communications, or choose this charity under account settings. Thank you for supporting Catholic Spirit Radio through 2820 Communications with your Amazon Smile purchase.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're talking about our topic today, liberal suicide. And we were talking about the fact that in Russia, back in the early part of the 20th century, a lot of the same kind of violence and opposition to the status quo was going on. And the target, of course, was people of property, businessmen, educators, and so forth. And yet these very same people not only did not oppose this movement, they actually supported it. And when the movement actually gained power, they were the first targets of the movement, the first persons to be liquidated. So why is it that they did not act? Why is it that they stood by, not only stood by, but even helped in this process? That question has bothered many students of revolutionary movements. Revolutions never succeed without the support of wealthy, liberal, educated society. And isn't that the case right now? Aren't we finding out that some of the people now finally are starting to be arrested? And when those people are unmasked and identified, they turn out to be the sons and daughters of very wealthy and liberal people, people who own a lot of property. These are the very people, their fathers and mothers and so forth, are the very targets of this revolution. And yet their fathers and mothers, in many cases, are actually supporting and helping the revolution. So what's going on? Yet revolutionaries seldom conceal that their success entails the seizure of all wealth, the suppression of dissenting opinion, and the murder of class enemies. And that's already starting to happen here. Lenin, after all, was by no means the only bloodthirsty Russian radical. In 1907, Ivan Pavlov, and it's not the Pavlov that was the behaviorist scientist who experimented, you know, with the behavioral responses of animals. It's a different Pavlov. At any rate, but one of the brightest theoreticians of the especially violent maximalists published The Purification of Mankind, which divided humanity into ethical races. And don't we have this in our society right now being divided up into various political groups, or identity groups? In this analysis, exploiters, vaguely and broadly identified, constituted a race morally inferior to our animal predecessors, according to Pavlov, which must be exterminated, children and all, by the morally superior race whose best members were the terrorists themselves. Remarkably enough, this program evoked no indignation among other maximalists or even among other socialists, however moderate that these people might be. In other words, it didn't evoke any opposition among ordinary liberals. Another prominent maximalist, M.A. Engelgart, argued for a red terror that would kill at least 12 million people. As if anticipating the Khmer Rouge, one anarchist group sought to establish equality by killing all educated people, and yet it was the educated people who supported the movement. Yet the liberals refused to use their position in the Duma to make constitutionalism work. They would not participate in determining the government budget, but confined their activities to denouncing the government and defending terrorists. Even when Pyotr Stolypin, the most capable chief minister Nicholas II ever had, offered to enact the entire cadet program, the cadets still refused to cooperate. Evidently, their professed beliefs were less important than their emotional identification with radicalism of whatever sort. In one memorable scene, the hero of Solzhenitsyn's novel, November 1916, and this is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, we've talked about him before, he wrote The Gulag Archipelago and tried to show and understand, explain why all of this happened and how he came to be in the Gulag himself. But at any rate, the hero of his novel, November 16, Colonel Voronezhev, finds himself at a social gathering principally of cadet adherents, where everyone repeats the same progressive pieties. He soon grasps that each of them knew in advance what the others would say, but that it was imperative for them to meet and hear it all over again, what they collectively knew. They were all overwhelmingly certain that they were right, yet they still needed these exchanges to reinforce their certainty. To his surprise, Voronezhev, as if under a spell, finds himself joining in. It requires an effort to remind himself that what these progressives say about the people, whom they do not know at all, contradicts everything that he himself has learned from his acquaintances with thousands of soldiers and ordinary citizens. When Voronezhev ventures the slightest discordant observations, just one little thing in opposition to them, they were all on their guard. They fell silent as they had been speaking in unison, and their silence was aimed at the colonel. He retreats and, as if hypnotized, repeats progressive pieties along with all the rest. What is this strange political hypnosis? Vorontsev gives ground and holds his peace, not because he felt he was wrong, but out of fear of saying something reactionary, a word Solzhenitsyn italicizes to suggest that in other cultures and periods, a different term of opprobrium will play the same role. And what's the term we have in our culture today that is equivalent to the word reactionary, Lynn? It also starts with an R.
Revolutionary?
Absolutely not. What's the term that is bandied about today continuously and people fear the most that ever be called? It certainly is.
Begins with an R.
Common, and it begins with an R also. It's racism. It's the idea of being called a racist today and the constant drumming of racism, racism, racism in every conceivable form to every conceivable group. It plays the same role that the word reactionary did in Russia. We might wonder, why in Russia was it so horrible to be called a reactionary? For the same reason in the United States that it's so horrible to be called a racist. The word was imbued with all kinds of negative meanings, that you were against the people, that you were against change, that you were uneducated, that you were a so-called fascist and a right-wing, you know, radical. So it's the same thing here. In other words, soldiers who are brave under fire cower before progressive opinion and before that word. For a long time, Vorontsov cannot bring himself to voice counter-arguments against these people. And he despised himself for it. It was a contagious disease. There was no resisting it if you came too close. And isn't that a lot what's happening today? People are terrified to be called a bigot or a racist.
But you're being called that no matter what you do.
It's true, but people are still cowed by name-calling,
yes,
and that's exactly what this is.
I agree.
At last, Vorontsov finds it in himself to resist. Soon after, he discusses the encounter with Professor Andravskaya, who explains that she, like professors at many universities today, must choose every word so carefully. And the fact is that when the word today is referring back to the first part of the 20th century, but that word today can be referring to what's going on now. On college campuses, you have to be very, very careful about what you say, whether you're a student or a professor. In educated Russian society, by no means every view may be expressed, and it's the same here. A whole school of thoughts is morally forbidden. And isn't there a lot of school of morally forbidden today?
Right, but just look at Father Altman.
Exactly.
Speaking the truth. He's being persecuted. He may be the prophet for today.
He's speaking Catholic traditionalist truth, and he's being censored and persecuted.
By whom, too? Look at by whom?
By people in the church, and we'll get to that. But the fact is that people today, if you try to talk about individual responsibility or individual virtue, you can't talk about that today. Everybody is categorized by their group identity politics. And if you dare say, I like to judge people on an individual basis, you're considered a racist. And you're be called also, the worst thing to be called is right wing. If you disagree, you're suddenly right wing, or you're a fascist. And so there are certain subjects that you can't talk about.
No, but no matter what you do, you're going to be called a racist.
Unless you join with the crowd. One prominent cadet, Peter Struve, did break with liberated opinion. He pointed out the absurdity of liberal intolerance and the suicidal insanity of backing bloodthirsty revolutionaries. And there's where we get our title, Liberal Suicide, or The Suicide of Liberals, as the article is titled. After the Bolshevik takeover, he blamed liberals for the disastrous consequences that they might have prevented. Struve was not entirely alone in trying to alert educated society. In 1909, he joined six other thinkers to publish Landmarks, a collection of essays on the Russian intelligentsia, and there's a word that we'll be using. In addition to Alexander Izguev, another prominent cadet, the contributors included Nikolai Bedyayev, Sergei Bulgakov, and Semyon Frank, who would reshape Russian Orthodox theology. Legal scholar Bogdan Kistiavetsky and literary critic Mikhail Gershenson, who edited the volume. One of the most important documents of Russian thought, Landmarks, is a must for anyone investigating the mentality of the intelligentsia, and that's exactly where we're going and what we're going to do. Landmarks caused unprecedented scandal. It went through 5 editions in about a year, and the 5th included an appendix listing more than 200 books and articles answering, mostly vilifying it. If the contributors aim to promote reasoned dialogue, foster intellectual tolerance, and sway liberal opinion away from automatic radicalism, they failed spectacularly. Most cadets disassociated themselves from the book, and the party leader Milyanikov toured the country to denounce it for betraying the sacred traditions of the Russian intelligentsia. The volume's unforgivable sin, Frank explained, lay in its criticism of the basic sacred dogma of the radical intelligentsia, the mystique of revolution. This was regarded as an audacious and quite intolerable betrayal of the age-old testament of the Russian intelligentsia, the betrayal of the tradition handed down by the prophets and saints of Russian social thought, Belinsky, Granovsky, Chernyshevsky, and Pizarev. In other words, the book was going against the tradition and idea of revolution. And that was not allowable. And isn't that a lot of what's happening today? And it was going against, of course, the political thinking of the time. To follow the volume's argument, one needs to grasp how the contributors used the word intelligentsia and intelligent. An intelligent would be a member of the intelligentsia at that time. Intelligentsia is a word that originated in Russia, where it was coined about 1860. Used in its strict, proper, or classical sense, it means something entirely different from its English equivalent. To be an intelligent, it was by no means sufficient or even necessary to be well-educated. And if by intellectual one means a curious person, thinking for himself or herself, then intelligent was actually close to its opposite. 3 characteristics identified a classical intelligent. To begin with, an intelligent identified primarily as an intelligent, rather than by his social class, profession, ethnic group, or other social category. In other words, this is what he primarily considered himself as. And you know, maybe, I'm going to put in here, I don't have a lot of time, but a hierarchical society in a society of class people would be a better society than a society of so-called equals, because this equality can become a dangerous thing where everyone can identify with a large particular group called the intelligentsia, whereas before various peoples identified with their own particular class or their own particular hierarchical place in society. And it provided far more diversity than a democratic equality society seems to do. And so maybe it's a dangerous situation to have a more democratic society. No one would have considered Tolstoy an intelligent, for example, in part because he used his title, Count. There were some people in Russia that were more, they identified with, you know, their title or in the hierarchy or with their particular class. Unless an intelligent was wealthy, or like Lenin, could become a professional revolutionary living at his party's expense, he had to work. But as a matter of honor, he did not take his profession seriously. As Izguev remarks, the average rank and file intelligent usually does not know his job and does not like it. He is a poor teacher, a poor engineer. He regards his profession as a sideline that does not deserve respect. If he is enthusiastic about his profession, he can expect the cruelest sarcasm from his friends. And I think you see a lot of that on college campuses and among professors and so forth, deprecating themselves and not really taking their particular field seriously. Instead, they identify themselves as a member of the intelligentsia or a member of the movement. And the college campus becomes, for them, a place to advocate the cause rather than to really practice their profession or practice their particular educational specialty. And we see a lot of this today. Teachers who should be teaching one thing are actually teaching something else instead, and that is their particular belief in their cause or their movement. At the extreme, an intelligent followed the prescripts of Sergei Nedyev's Catechism of a Revolutionary and severed all ties with the civic order, renouncing family and even his own name. Of course, most people don't go that far, but you see among the so-called revolutionaries in the streets certain ones who are, in effect, severed from society and their own families, and that's all they do. The Landmark's contributors mention a second characteristic of intelligence, their devotion to a special set of manners, including dress, hygiene, deliberately poor, and don't we see that today, hairstyle, and prescribed taboo expressions, and we have all the microaggressions today that are prescribed taboo expressions. So we're going to stop here and take a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back and finish the conclusion of what goes on in these particular kinds of movements. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Here's an easy way to donate to Catholic Spirit Radio. As an Amazon shopper, you can donate 0.5% of your purchase cost to Catholic Spirit Radio, also known as 2820 Communications. Before making a purchase, you will always need to log into smile.amazon.com, search and select 2820 Communications, or choose this charity under account settings. Thank you for supporting Catholic Spirit Radio through 2820 Communications with your Amazon Smile purchase.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're talking about liberal suicide. We're talking about what's going on in our society today. A lot of the protests, the violence, and suppression of free speech and opinion and so forth that is happening more and more in our society. And we're asking the question, why is it that often the very targets of this, at least the people who will become the very targets of this, know and understand this, but can't seem to actually do anything but support this movement as it goes along, actually support the violence and so forth. And we're taking a look at what happened in Russia back at the first part of the 20th century and as a comparison of what's going on today and why many, many people who should know better are frozen and can't act. And we're getting at that. The fact is that they belong with a group in which it simply is almost impossible to protest or to disagree without being severely shunned or severely put down. And a lot of these people belonging to such groups and organizations, thinking of themselves as revolutionaries or thinking of themselves as a particular part of the intelligentsia, are afraid individually to speak up, each one waiting for someone else to do something, and each one afraid to do anything himself and sort of going along with the crowd, being pushed along. And as it gets things get worse and worse, they themselves becoming actually more and more determined and violent along those lines.
Is that what we're seeing with the police and the city governments? City governments and mayors are saying, no, leave the people alone.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a little bit more about the defunding of the police, if we can get through this. a separate little world with its own very strong and rigorous tradition, its own adequate mores and customs. Nowhere in Russia are there such a clear and strict regulation of life, such categorical judgments of people and situations, and such loyalty to the corporate spirit as this all-Russian spiritual monastery, the Russian intelligentsia. And there we go, the word, a monastery. In other words, it's almost a religious movement. And I've said before that all principles at bottom are ultimately religious. And the intelligentsia movement in Russia, in effect, was. And I think the intelligentsia movement here in the United States, in effect, is also. And people who are caught up and involved in it dare not oppose it for being turned on by the group itself. The revolution eats its own is what one of the sayings came out of the Russian Revolution. There are stories of aristocrats taking lessons in the right kind of bad manners. In other words, you had to act the part and you had to know what to do, and they actually took lessons. Isn't that the same thing as the so-called diversity training that corporations and so forth are sponsoring to this day? That you're forced almost to go in if you belong to certain groups and take the so-called training done by people who are no more expert in things except that they seem to know exactly how to go along with the crowd, and they make fortunes and get rich off of this so-called diversity training, which is actually telling the very people who pay for it how no good they are. It actually is aimed at those people, and these people are informed and told about what's going to happen to them, and yet they go right along with it because each one individually is afraid to object. And finally, most important and of greatest concern was how intelligent thought, that is how intelligence thought, and again, remember, an intelligent in the Russian term was a member of the intelligentsia, and we can use the same term here today. An intelligence signed on to a set of beliefs regarded as totally certain, scientifically proven, and we get that today all the time, science, 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 which is ridiculous because most of it is not scientific at all, and absolutely obligatory for any moral person. I mean, you have to believe in global, you know, or climate change. You have to believe in all kinds of various things that are prescribed and ascribed by the crowd and by the intelligentsia itself.
For instance, one of the vice, the presidents, one of the Biden, I was trying to avoid his name, but isn't Biden saying we have to depend on science, what science tells us?
Yes, and then there are all kinds of unscientific things that are concluded from that. It says a strict intelligent had to subscribe to some ideology, whether populist, Marxist, or anarchist, that was committed to the total destruction of the existing order and its replacement by a utopia that would, at a stroke, eliminate every human ill. And this, again, is one of the fundamental factors of movements like this, is that somehow they are going to have a materialistic, earthly movement that is going to transform things into a wonderful society, because, of course, the earth and the material that we live in is flawed. In fact, from the Catholic point of view, as taught in Scripture and as Jesus Christ taught, this earth is passing away, and there is no particular place to stand on this earth in any absolute fashion. Everything, every stand you take from the point of view of pure materialism is always relativistic, and there's no real stand that you can take. Once you abandon the absolute authority of God and the absolute dogmas that have been handed down to us, especially by Jesus Christ and through the Christian Catholic religion, you become lost. There's nothing on this earth that is for certain. Again, the truth has been told. This earth is passing away. It doesn't provide a very solid platform on which to stand. This aspiration was often described as apocalyptic, and has been observed, it is no accident that many of the most influential intelligence, from Chernensky to Stalin, came from clerical families. That is families that were involved in the priesthood, the Orthodox Church, and so forth. Or maybe they themselves had actually been in seminary. Some of them had, or had studied in seminaries. For Struve, the mentality of the intelligentsia constituted a cruel parody of religion, preserving the external features of religion without its content. And we get some of that today in our own bishops and clergy. We get some of this, the following the actual material world in the political society and the ideological society instead of following the strict tenets of their Catholic faith and thinking that by deviating from it, that they can bring greater good to this passing world and somehow they can invoke or introduce or put into place a more idealistic society, which is usually always fatal. An intelligent could not be a believer, which is another reason no one would have considered Tolstoy, let alone that conservative Dostoevsky, an intelligent. They accepted, that is, the intelligence, accepted atheism on faith. They were spiritually devoted to materialism and proselytized determinism. They base these commitments on science, a word they use over and over to mean not a disinterested process or discovery based on experiment and evidence, but, and here the reason becomes perfectly circular, a metaphysics of materialism and determinism. Still worse, intelligentsia science entailed an assertion that the world worked by blind, purposeless force. Isn't that what we have today by our scientists? And yet, as if guided by providence, was guaranteed to progress in human terms and reach moral perfection. And this is what you have from these protesters and rioters and violent people. On the one hand, proclaiming that religion is, the opiate of the masses, that religion is stupid and that only materialism and earthly, beliefs are worth having and that the world is totally purposeless, yet they will proclaim that history is unfolding along the lines of their predictions, just as the communists said that, Marx proclaimed that history was unfolding along the lines of dialectical materialism and establishing the communist state. Yet at the same time believing that everything was purposeless. They held contradictions, and the people today hold these contradictions. In the same spirit, Bulgakov observed that the intelligentsia asserts that the personality is wholly a product of the environment, and don't we get that today? And at the same time suggests to it that it improve its surroundings. Like Baron Munchausen, pulling himself up out of the swamp by his own hair. I'm not sure who Baron Munchausen was, but there must be some kind of a story about a baron who somehow pulled himself out of a swamp by his own hair. We would use the term lifting ourselves up by our own bootstraps, and the whole thing is ridiculous. That somehow or another, even though everything is blind, purposeless force, we're going to somehow or another, and we're a product of that blind, purposeless force, and we're a meaningless product at that, we are somehow going to pull ourselves up to some kind of a purposeful level by our own bootstraps. This is the kind of contradictions that these intelligentsia believe in. If there was one philosophy, this is a term invented by a man called Struve, if there was one philosophy shared by intelligence, it was the assumption that all questions must be judged politically, and aren't we getting that way today? Thus, one could discredit a scientific theory not by logic or evidence, but by calling its implications reactionary. And what don't we call reactionary? The same thing here. I mean, we can believe in some of the goofiest scientific projections and policies, such as the climate change, global warming, then global cooling, and then just climate change itself, and ascribe it to everything man-made, especially all of it being ascribed to the tiny country of the United States. And when I say tiny, I mean tiny in the sense of relative to the rest of the world. that somehow or another we can change the whole climate of the planet right here in the United States, and that these politicians, if they have the power and authority, they can somehow or another undo all of this and turn our climate back into some kind of a beneficent project again. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. The Soviets banned at one time or another genetic relativity and quantum theory, not on criteria from their respective disciplines, but on the basis of their supposed incompatibility with dialectical materialism. Such politicians disparage philanthropy as a betrayal of all mankind and its eternal salvation for the sake of a few individuals close at hand. In other words, the whole profession of the intelligentsia is to love that thing called humanity while they hate people. And this is exactly, in other words, instead of applauding decency and philanthropy that would help all human beings, they proclaimed that this is only helping a few human beings while they are going to help the whole world. Intelligentsia ethics appalled the landmark essayist. If everything is political, then the cruelest means are not only permitted but obligatory. What is more, the very tactics the revolutionaries condemn became acceptable when the revolutionaries themselves used them. Sound familiar? The argument comes naturally to liberal-minded people. What if the shoe were on the other foot, was rejected in principle? For an intelligent, there is no other foot. In Solzhenitsyn's August 1914, when young Veronica criticizes revolutionaries for doing just what they condemn, her intelligent aunts are shocked. Why, the unfeeling girl was equating the oppressors of the people with its liberators, speaking as though they had the same moral rights as we, the liberators, do. Let him, the intelligent, kill. The party takes all the blame upon itself, so that terror is no longer murder, expropriation is no longer robbery. In other words, according to the ants, what they were doing is different. Why? Because they're the liberators and the other people are not, even though they're doing the same thing, according to their thinking. Such thinking is a major convenience, Gershenson observed, because it removes all moral responsibility from the individual. Again, see, there's this group think and condemnation of actual individual judgment. Writing about a decade after Landmarks, the philosopher Mikhail Bakhtin called such an excuse a spurious alibi and insisted there is no alibi. The intelligentsia constituted one Russian intellectual tradition, the great writers another. And we'll go on here. Though some liberals recognized their differences from the radicals, most acted like intelligentsia wannabes who were willing to acknowledge, even to themselves, that their values were essentially different. Socialized to regard anything conservative as reprehensible, and don't we get that today? If you try to conserve the status quo, somehow you're a fascist.
Oh, just the word conservatism.
Right. They contrived ways to justify radical intolerance and violence as forced, understandable, and noble. They had to, since the fundamental emotional premise of liberalism, hostility to those ignorant, bigoted, morally depraved people on the right, almost always proved more compelling than professed intellectual commitments. Berdyaev observed, these liberals illustrated how moral cowardice develops while love of truth and intellectual daring are extinguished. Captivated by public opinion, they signed petitions they did not agree with and excuse heinous acts, always observing the rule, it's better to side with people a mile to one's left than to be associated with anyone even an inch to one's right. Educated society knew that one could not just abolish the police, as the anarchists demanded, and aren't they demanding that today, to abolish the police? And that socialism would not instantly cure all this, but they assured themselves that progressive opinion must somehow be right, and it would all work out in the end. And, of course, it turned into a total horrible disaster. They warned, the Landmarks people, they warned, as Dostoevsky had in the possess, that to the extent that a society's educated class comes to resemble an intelligentsia in the Russian sense, it is headed for what we now call totalitarianism. And that's exactly where our intelligentsia class is going. When a party is willing to push its power as far as it can go, it will keep on going until it meets sufficient opposition. In the French Revolution, terror was eventually stopped by Napoleon. But in Russia, Stalin proclaimed the intensification of the class struggle after the revolution, entailing an unending series of arrests, executions, and sentences to the gulag. And the lesson from this is, what meets no resistance does not stop.
Exactly. So silence is complicity.
Exactly. Very, very well observed, Lynn. So we're going to stop the article here. I hope it's been enlightening, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more discussion about this to some extent next week.
Right. We could do a lot of discussion. In the meantime, see if you can find Father James Altman, A-L-T-M-A-N, Father Altman, La Crosse, Wisconsin. His sermons are a gem.
At any rate, St. Michael the Archangel,
defend us in battle.
Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, Prince of the heavenly host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all the spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.